The following is intended only for mature audiences. Listener discretion is advised. Welcome back to the Eerie Crossroads, where folklore and asphalt meet. This is Anthology of Horror, and I am your navigator through the supernatural. I am Springheeled Jack. As the days lengthen and the open road beckons, today's episode, chosen by our ever-curious audience via another engaging Instagram poll, delves into the chilling tales of hauntings from America's roads and highways. For those with a thirst for the thrill of the drive, and the mysteries that lurk along its margins, make sure to steer your way over to Instagram and follow me at DukeLandis17, where you can cast your vote on the future episodes and take the wheel in guiding our eerie journey. So as many of you longtime listeners might have realized, there's a tradition here at the Anthology of Horror podcast. With the arrival of warmer weather and the onset of road trip season, we venture into the haunted tales of the highways. Those long stretches of pavement that host stories of ghostly hitchhikers, cursed routes, and spectral phenomena that appear in the rearview mirror. Road trips and long drives, as you all know, are a passion of mine, and crafting these episodes bring me nearly as much joy as hitting the road for a new adventure myself. I must say, though, today the studio feels a bit more spacious and decidedly quieter without the presence of Sam Stoutman and Scary Jerry, whose stories and insights filled the air with a palpable sense of intrigue and dread when they were here. Their absence today turns our focus even sharper onto the lonely roads and the tales that they hold. So buckle up, adjust your mirrors, and prepare for a journey through the haunted byways of America. From the shadow-haunted stretches of Route 66 to the ghost-infested lanes of the Blue Ridge Parkway, we're exploring what makes these roads worthy of their eerie reputations. Let us drive into the twilight together, where the only thing more thrilling than the destinations are the ghost stories that you collect along the way. God damn it, it's lonely in here.
Such a lonely day, and it's mine. The most loneliest day of my life. Such a lonely day should be banned. It's a day that I can't stand. The most loneliest day of my life. The most loneliest day of my life.
The history of roads in America is a fascinating journey through time, reflecting the nation's evolution from a rugged frontier to a connected superpower. This journey, spanning several centuries, highlights the changing needs and technological advancements that shaped the vast network of roadways that crisscross the United States today. This is going to be a sum up, a quick one, I promise. The story begins in the pre-colonial era with Native American trails, which were paths formed by indigenous people and often followed natural landscapes like rivers and mountain ridges. These trails were essential for trade and communication among tribes across the continent. As European settlers arrived and the colonies were established, the need for more structured roadways became very apparent. One of the earliest roads was the Boston Post Road, established in the 17th century to carry mail between Boston and New York City. This period saw the development of several such post roads and rudimentary highways, primarily dirt paths that were difficult to traverse but became nearly impassable in bad weather. The Turnpike era, starting in the late 18th century, marked the first major attempt to finance and construct better quality roads through the use of tolls. Private companies built roads and charged travelers a fee or a toll to use them, hence the name Turnpike, derived from the gate mechanism that was used to block passage until the toll was paid. The early 19th century witnessed significant federal involvement in road construction with the authorization of the National Road in 1806, also known as the Cumberland Road. It was the first major federally funded road that was a building project of the United States federal government, and it stretched from Cumberland, Maryland to Vandalia, Illinois, and it played a crucial role in the westward expansion and development of the Midwest. The advent of the automobile in the early 20th century radically transformed road infrastructure. With the increasing popularity of motor vehicles, there was a pressing demand for improved and paved roads. The Federal Aid Road Act of 1916 and later the Federal Highway Act of 1921 provided substantial federal funds to states for highway construction, and it required states to develop official highway agencies to receive these funds. The 1920s saw the creation of numbered state highway systems, notably the iconic Route 66, which was built in 1926 running from Chicago to L.A. This route became emblematic of America's car culture and the freedom and mobility that automobiles granted to ordinary Americans. The development of America's roads reached a new epic with the passage of the Federal Highway Aid Act in 1956, largely championed by President Eisenhower, who had been impressed by the German Autobahn during World War II. The act authorized the construction of the interstate highway system, an expansive network of expressways that would connect major cities across the country. The system was designed for high-speed, long-distance travel, facilitating efficient movement of military assets across the country, but also profoundly impacting commercial activity and the American lifestyle. And it encouraged suburban growth and making cross-country travel accessible to the masses. The construction of this extensive network of interstates used a uniform design standard, which included controlled access, multiple lanes, paved shoulders, and a lack of traffic signals, allowing for uninterrupted high-speed travel. This system dramatically altered the landscape of American travel, commerce, and urban development. Today, the U.S. boasts over 4 million miles of roadways, with significant portions dedicated to the interstate system. These roads not only contribute to support economic activity and provide vital arteries for personal and commercial travel, but they also symbolize the American spirit of exploration and mobility. The evolution from simple dirt paths to sophisticated multi-lane interstates mirrors the technological, economic, and social transformations of the United States itself. If you guys want a more in-depth analysis of the history of American car culture and all of that, make sure to listen to our Route 66 episode for a far more comprehensive breakdown. So, when I do stories like this, I tend to focus mainly on places that I have been personally. However, that won't be the case today. Sorry in advance to my listeners abroad, I don't think I have any non-American stories that are worth telling, but I do have some good ones from the United States. But before we get started with all that ghostly bullshit, I want to read you an excerpt from an old handwritten biker journal I found and bought at a used bookstore years back. The journal is filled with all sorts of ramblings written at truck stops and rest stations. Admittedly, it does have some problematic worldviews written inside of it that are written about at uncomfortable and great lengths. He is also greatly amused every time he has to take a shit on the side of the road and has a hard time getting through a single entry without bringing up how much he loves meth. But inside of all that roadside bullshit, I found this nugget of old biker wisdom that I'd like to share. Or at least, it seems to me like a nugget of wisdom, but it may just be the ramblings of somebody who fried their brain with stimulants. It's titled, August 6th, 6 p.m., some shithole town, an hour or so outside of Stockton. A few days ago, while heading north, I accidentally took the wrong exit and stumbled upon a secluded rural road running parallel to the freeway. With no other cars in sight, I decided to take this less traveled route, which quickly became a favorite detour of this trip. For about an hour, I followed this charming path until it curved into a breathtaking vista of lush green wetlands, replacing the familiar farmland. Eager to capture this sudden shift in scenery, I pulled over to take some photos to share once I got back home. However, as I reached down to set down my kickstand, my boot snagged on something. I glanced down and couldn't help but chuckle when I discovered it was an old marble, Clearly, a child's toy at some point. It was worn down on one side from its adventures on the road, and I found myself pondering its history, how it got there, who it belonged to, and the journey it must have taken to end up in my hands, covered in dirt, on a road not marked on any map. This marble brought to mind a saying among my friends who cherish the freedom of the open road, and that is, the road takes everything back. We'd usually toss this phrase around jokingly when somebody lost something valuable during our travels, yet, holding that worn marble, the saying took on a new, profound significance. The road, in its vast, meandering way, offers us incredible gifts, scenes of untouched beauty, unexpected adventures, and even the people we grow to love. But it also serves as a reminder of the transient nature of life. Just as the road brought that marble through countless unknown journeys before leaving it for me to find, it similarly carries us through life's peaks and valleys. The road introduced me to my loved ones, and inevitably it will play a part in our eventual partings. In this way, the road is a metaphor for life itself, both giving and reclaiming, in a perpetual cycle of loss and discovery. I thought it was interesting. Hopefully you guys did as well. So much like that was an old journal entry that's being released now on a new medium of podcasting, or new-ish media, I should say. I sound like a fucking old man. But right now, this section of the podcast episode is titled Old Legends Told in a New Way. I'll spare you guys a dramatic retelling of Resurrection Mary because I've done it more times than I can count on this show. This first story is called The Prophecy. You're out with friends, minding your own business when a stranger intrudes. What do you do if that uninvited guest begins to predict the future, especially if ignoring the prophecy could result in your own death, and that spectral visitor is from the church? Three young men had to face these questions and more when they picked up the wrong hitchhiker in the shadow of a volcano. What's black and white, and black and white, and black and white all over? I don't know, Christopher, what? A nun rolling down a hill. Wait, I got one, Francis chimed in. What do you call a nun that walks in her sleep? A Roman Catholic. Now that's just stupid. And yours wasn't? Come on, guys, broke in Anthony, enough with the nun jokes, or we're all gonna, you know where we're gonna go. Where, to Mother Superior's office? Again? Oh no, not the ruler. No, Anthony warned, pointing a finger straight down, someplace lower. The three students knew that they were alone in the car, but maybe God was listening. Better to be safe than sorry, so they cut out the jokes. As they drove silently on I-5 from Eugene, Oregon to Tacoma, Washington, the huge mountain loomed off to their right in the distance. Although they had always lived beside the volcano, the boys had never given it much thought. There hadn't been a major rumble from Mount St. Helens since they were born. The boys had studied the volcano in school. People were living on its slopes, located in the Cascades mountain range, at least 6,500 years ago. About 1,500, a major eruption buried anyone and anything in the area under a deep deposit of pumice. Native Americans had avoided the volcano for 2,000 years. But by the time that Lewis and Clark expedition reached the Pacific in 1805, various local Native American tribes had been settling in the foothills for about 1,000 years. Although the famous explorers saw the volcano as they floated downstream on the Columbia River, they didn't witness any activities. But Mount St. Helens had erupted only 5 to 10 years earlier. Over the next 60 years, there would be occasional seismic tremors, as well as the so-called Great Eruption of 1842. But as of now, everyone was safe. It was the early spring of 1980. Although smoke plumes were seen from time to time, in fact, there was even one now, the volcano had last erupted in 1854. Francis, the history buff, knew lots of ancient legends that explained the formation and eruptions at Mount St. Helens. His favorite came from the Klick-Tat tribe. Their chief god, Taihi Sighali, and his two sons, Klickitat, or Paho, and Wai-Yeast. They came in from the north to settle at the narrows of the Columbia, near the present-day city of The Dalles, Oregon. What was it about the Dalles that attracted settlers, thought Francis? It had also been the end of the land journey on the Oregon Trail. In any case, in the volcano creation myth, the sons began to fight for possession of the land, To separate them, their father shot two arrows in opposite directions and told his sons each to follow one and settle where the arrow fell. He built a passage, the Bridge of the Gods, between them. But unfortunately, that didn't end the family squabbles. Both sons fell in love with a young woman named Luwit, and their violent fights over her devastated the earth, causing earthquakes, leveling forests, and destroying the Sky Bridge, which tumbled to the ground to form the Cascade Mountain Range. Finally, to put an end to the destruction, Sigali turned all three of the others into stone. His son Klickitat became what today is called Mount Adams. To the south, his brother Wyeast became Mount Hood. And beautiful Luwit was transformed into Mount St. Helens, which was called Lugwala Clough, or Smokefire Mountain, by the Klickitat. The guys checked out the peak of the mountain. A little smoke trail today, but nothing to be worried about. Besides, there were scientists up there now, apparently checking it out. Wouldn't they tell people if it were going to explode? Holy Mother of Jesus, look at that. Christopher motioned up ahead. About 50 yards down the highway, standing alone on the shoulder of the road, was a woman. She looked to be about 50 or 60 years old. She was in a black dress, a white collar, and a black and white wimple. The look was unmistakable. She was indeed a nun. Should have hit her with the door and kept driving, if you ask me, but I went to Catholic school. As they watched, the sister smiled gently, and then at the last second, almost comically, stuck a curved thumb up into the air. She was hitchhiking. A hitchhiking nun. Now they had indeed seen everything. You think we should pick her up? You have to, dude. She's a nun. Isn't there some kind of rule that we have to stop and help her out? Do you really think she's a nun? Do you think we can risk it if she's not? What if we leave her standing there and, I don't know, somebody finds out? I told you we shouldn't have been telling those jokes. All right, everybody, take a deep breath, Christopher warned as he slowed the car. Best behavior, we're going in. A slight pause, and then all three burst out laughing. A Star Wars quote? Nice touch, Chris. How about this one? I have a very bad feeling about this. Luke, use the Force. They were still chuckling as the car came to a halt. Polite to a fault, all three boys stepped out of the car. Francis spoke up first. May we offer you a ride, sister? We're only going a few miles up the road, just to Tacoma. When she spoke, they were surprised to hear such a soft voice, not stern like their teachers at school. Tacoma would be fine. Thank you. Francis, realizing that he had been riding shotgun, opened the front passenger door for the sister. Once she was inside, he closed the door carefully and hopped in and sat in the back with Anthony. Where are you boys heading? To Bellarmine Preparatory? Bellarmine, the three guys thought. Although that didn't happen to be where they were headed, they knew where the school was. Bellarmine in Tacoma was one of the leading Catholic prep schools in the whole area. How could she know just by looking at them that they were Catholic? Were nuns psychic, too? Yes. Yes, without a doubt they are. The sister couldn't help but notice the quizzical expressions on their faces. With a twinkle in her eye, she explained, Forgive me if I'm wrong, and I doubt that I am, but I knew you must be Catholic. You were so well-mannered that when you stopped to assist me, I just assumed you've been raised in Catholic schools. Her voice was smooth, liquid, calming. Why couldn't she be teaching one of their classes? That voice made you want to listen to her all day. Before long, she was sharing her story. What had brought her to that spot on the road where they had first spied her. She was on a mission, she said, a sort of assignment she had been instructed. She didn't say by whom to perform. She was just said to meet strangers, people in need of help. But then her tone darkened. Yes, she said. It was like the story in the Old Testament of the young man who appeared at Lot's gate. If her message was well received, goodness would come to the people who heard her words. But if she was met with disbelief or hostility, the offenders would surely suffer the wrath of the Lord. The boys squirmed in their seats. This was not what they wanted to hear. They were just out having fun, but they couldn't ask a nun to hold off on the preaching, could they? Was this some kind of a test? Was God watching them? Anthony involuntarily looked skyward. Her voice, once again like honey, now was becoming stern and menacing, but they couldn't resist hanging on her words. As Jesus said in the book of St. Matthew, If anyone will not welcome you or listen to your words, shake the dust off your feet when you leave that home or town. I tell you the truth. It will be more bearable for Sodom and Gomorrah on the day of judgment than for that town. Now the guys were freaked out. What was she trying to tell them? They stared into her face, but it was no longer gentle and loving. It had become transfixed and severe. Her voice became enraptured, prophetic, and her whole manner had become detached, almost as if she were possessed. Suddenly it occurred to the boys, she was no longer directly addressing them. She was delivering a prophecy. The nun turned her unfathomable face towards the side window. She stared up at the dome of Mount St. Helens. For I tell you this, the time approaches. Those who do not seek forgiveness for their transgressions and do not change the errors of their ways, they will be consumed by fire and ash. And as it is such, so also as such is it unto you. The clouds parted, and as the last rays of sun burst upon the side of the towering mountain, it became crystal clear. She was telling them that the volcano was going to erupt, and soon. If they weren't penitent, or didn't seek absolution, were those the right words? They would surely die in the explosion. Then the most incredible thing the boys had ever experienced, and indeed ever would experience, happened. The nun began to glow, and then with a small pop, she vanished. Startled, Christopher involuntarily slammed on the brakes and veered onto the side of the road. Had that really just happened? Where was she? How could she have just have disappeared? But clearly, the miracle had taken place. The front passenger seat screamed its emptiness. Struck dumb, the young men continued on to Tacoma without saying a word. The boys never told anybody about their ethereal visitor. If they had, who would have believed them? Besides, they had enough demerits at school. They certainly weren't going to start telling stories about a doomsday prophecy-spewing nun. Everyone would dismiss it as a tasteless prank, or worse, a drug-induced hallucination. If the boys had checked in with the Tacoma police, however, they would have found their encounter was not unique. Over the past year, more than 20 reports had come from individuals as well as carloads of people who had experienced exactly the same thing. They had all stopped to pick up a middle-aged woman, usually but not always dressed in a nun's habit, who warned the motorist that if they didn't repent their sins, they would die in an accident on the highway. In the last couple of months, she had changed her apocalyptic story to center on Mount St. Helens. As it turns out, the nun was right, at least partially. On May 18, 1980, after several months of underground murmurs, Mount St. Helens erupted. The north side of the mountain blew out, causing a debris avalanche that stripped away everything in its path. Plumes of pumice and steam followed, covering miles around with a layer of ash. 57 people were killed, and 250 houses were destroyed. Miles of road and railway were wiped out completely, as were 47 bridges. By far, it was the deadliest and costliest volcanic eruption in the history of the United States. Had the mysterious sister accurately predicted the desolation? Was she describing Mount St. Helens' eruption to her captive audiences at all? Or was she receiving a holy vision of Judgment Day? Had she even been a spirit? Or was she just an angel of the Lord? Or was she a demon from the bowels of hell? You know, I read a lot of these fucking stories, and it's rare that I ever get the heebie-jeebies from them, but maybe it's just something about nuns. This one definitely almost did something for me. Almost. I'd also never heard it until I researched this episode. I imagine it's one of those local ones you hear a whole lot in the Pacific Northwest, but I'd never encountered it, and almost gave me the chills. Almost. Thank you. All right, this next one is about another volcano. This one just happens to be on an island. Do the gods walk among us? And if so, why do they interact with mere mortals? One such deity, Madame Pele, is kind enough to drop by to warn us before her volcanic outbursts. Other times, her appearances augur misfortune, or are just simply mischief. But one thing is certain, she's here, and she's not going away. There was trouble in paradise. Pele, the daughter of Jesus Christ, Kane Hoalani, and the goddess Hoamia, was born in Kahiki, what is today called Tahiti. She had a huge family, and all of her brothers and sisters were gods or goddesses of different aspects of the natural world. Pele's specialty was fire, especially in the way it frequently showed itself throughout Polynesia. She possessed the power to produce the flames and molten lava of the volcano. But just like in many human families, there was constant quarreling and bickering among those brothers and sister deities. In Pele's case, the thorn in her side was her sister, Namaka Okahai, who was a goddess of the sea. To escape the rivalry, Pele asked her father for permission to leave Kahiki, and eventually he acquiesced. Pele formed a gigantic canoe and crossed the ocean to the northeast, but her troublesome sister followed with her. Pele arrived at the chain of islands we call Hawaii, stopping first at the tiny outcrop of Niihau, then moving on to Kauai, followed by Oahu. Every time Pele used her magic and her digging stick to create a new home for herself deep in the rock, Namaka Okahai would fill the hole with water, either by having it seep up through the ground or by tossing tidal waves up from the coast. The monumental battle between the sisters came to a head on the island of Maui, where Pele settled into the crater of Haleakala. Fire and water nearly consumed each other in the clash between the titans, and in the end, Pele was snuffed out and consumed. Her bones formed the huge cinder cone called Ka'iwi o Pele that can be seen on the road to Hana. Content in her victory, Namaka Okahai returned to Kahiki, but Pele lived on in spirit form. She moved to the Big Island of Hawaii, where she was finally able to dig a pit deep enough and far enough inland that it was out of her sister's reach. Her home is in that crater, on the 13,680-foot Mauna Loa volcano. A ridge road, crater rim drive, surrounds the great Kilauea caldera on the eastern slope of Mauna Loa. For years, drivers along the path have reported seeing a woman, usually young but sometimes elderly and often accompanied by a small white dog, walking the shoulder of the road. Legend has it that she is Pele, in human form. If she's wearing white, the motorist, or someone he or she knows, is going to fall ill. But if Pele is wearing red, it usually means a volcanic eruption will take place within days. Madame Pele seldom sits quietly for very long in her home at the bottom of the 280-foot-deep Haleakala crater, which is located within Kilauea caldera. She frequently becomes angry if the mortals living on her island don't worship her or leave her tributes, and in her blazing temper, she'll start a flow of lava or shoot sparks and flames high into the air. So strong is their belief that many locals try to appease Pele by laying offerings of chicken or alcohol along the rim of the crater. Also, according to legend, if you remove pieces of lava from the island, no matter how small, Pele will curse you. Bad luck will follow you until you return the stones to their native shores. Are these all quaint stories? Are they just ancient myths of gods and goddesses? Probably. And yet the appearances of Madame Pele's ghost on the Hawaiian Islands occur quite frequently, and the sightings are far too numerous to dismiss as the products of mere imagination. So if you're driving anywhere on the island in the middle of the night and you see a woman in a red muumuu on the side of the road asking for a lift, give careful thought before you pass her by. If it's Madame Pele, she'll disappear almost as soon as she steps into your car. But if it's the goddess and you don't offer her a lift, you'll undoubtedly anger her, which could result in your death and set off a new round of volcanic eruptions and devastation to the island. So is it worth taking the risk? Madame Pele still gives her forewarnings. Residents of Capahoa swear that in 1960 she showed up 2 days before the 2,600-foot-wide lava flow from the Mauna Loa destroyed their town. In fact, many old tales surround the volcanic eruptions that have affected the Capahoa region. In one of the best known, a local chieftain challenged a young lady to race him by sled down the mountainside. He was halfway down the slope when he looked beside him to discover that the woman was actually Madame Pele, and she was riding a river of lava. Also in recent years, the specter of a striking lady in the trademark flaming red muumuu was seen roaming the halls of the hotel towers in the Hilton Hawaiian Village in Honolulu, Hawaii. Now, some people think she's the phantom of a woman who was murdered in that hotel. But many locals believe she's the ghostly manifestation of Pele. The spirit certainly isn't warning the visitors about volcanoes, though. If you're in Hawaii on vacation, be careful whom you meet in your hotel hallway, because it could be Madame Pele paying a visit, and it could also be one of those famous Hawaiian hookers that I've heard so much about. This next one is also from Hawaii. It's called The Night Marchers. The folklore of Hawaii is filled with stories and spirit orbs, legends of the mysterious Menahun, or little people, as well as many tales of ghosts and apparitions. But none is more amazing than that of the Night Marchers, the parade of spirit warriors that pass over the old trails that crisscross the islands. Just seeing the procession can mean death, unless you're lucky enough to have somebody or something intervene. So cutting across the grassy plain of the Nuuana Valley, Kami knew he was late. Where had the time gone? It was already after sundown. And even though streaks of red still lit the western sky, he had promised his mother he would be home hours before this. Not that he was too young to be out on his own. Shit, he was almost 18. But as his mom had often warned him, you can't be too careful these days. You never know who you'll run into, or who will run into you. Cammy's mother meant that both figuratively and literally, because these days, drivers seem to be zooming across the island at top speed. If they were unfamiliar with the roads, and this was the height of tourist season, they could very easily drift just a little too much towards the shoulder and hit somebody innocently walking down the side of the highway. Which is one of the reasons that Cammy was now taking an alternate route, an unpaved hiking trail towards his home. Walking along the cliffs, Cammy always felt most in touch with his native Hawaiian roots, something his grandfather Maleko had installed in him when he was just a little boy. Maleko had still been a young man when businessmen, led by politician Sanford Doyle, a cousin of James Doyle, the Pineapple Man, overthrew Queen Liliuokalani in 1893. The queen, hoping to spare her subjects from bloodshed, asked them to be patient while she petitioned Washington, D.C. for the return of her throne. But many natives revolted against the new government anyway. The rebellion, of course, was squashed. But to his dying day, Maleko was proud that he had joined in the struggle. Liliuokalani was allowed to leave her house arrest in Lolani Palace in Honolulu in 1896, but there was no turning back for the islands. The monarchy had been dissolved forever. Over the years, as mainland people moved to Hawaii, more and more of the natives were forced to assimilate. But Maleko resisted. As he raised his children, he made sure they learned the language and all the ancient legends of his people. Then, as they had children of their own, Maleko insisted that they be taught the native customs as well. Now Maleko was gone, but Kami treasured the memory of the many life lessons he had learned at his grandfather's knee. That was one of the reasons he loved to walk on Nuuana Pali. Not only could one catch a panoramic view all the way from the top of the mountains down to the windward beaches of Oahu, but he also knew the area was steeped in Hawaiian history. In fact, the bloodiest battle in the fight for Hawaiian unification took place very close to where he was standing. In 1795, Kamehameha, known as King Kamehameha the Great, and 10,000 of his warriors sailed from his base on the island of Hawaii to conquer first Maui and then Molokai before moving to Oahu. in the fierce battle of Nuanakamahawa, drove the chieftain... Oh my god, I'm trying to pronounce these names, but be patient with me. I have no idea how this language works. Kalanikupule and his men across the valley floor, where Kaimi had been earlier that day, and up onto the perilous cliff. At the climax of the monumental clash, hundreds of Kalanikupule's warriors were forced over the precipice. In the aftermath, Kamehameha was able to bring all of the Hawaiian islands under his rule. The first road over the Nuanapali to collect the windward towns of Kandaho and Kalauea with Honolulu was constructed in 1845. When the road was upgraded in 1898, more than 800 souls, no doubt from the warriors who had plummeted to their deaths 100 years ago, were uncovered. In the 1950s, the aging motorway was replaced by the new Pali Highway, now State Route 61, with tunnels cut through the mountains to facilitate travel. Of all the tales that his grandfather had told him about Hawaii's ancient heritage, he liked the ghost stories the best. Maleko had warned him to always be on guard when he walked through the Nuanapali because it was haunted. For instance, they say that if you walk alone out in the fields or woodlands at night without a flashlight, you'll be attacked by a phantom woman dressed in white. Most often she just scares you, but some people claim that if you get too close to her, she'll kill you. Then if you drive past the cemetery across from Kahala Mall with your windows open, an invisible spirit will jump into your car with you. Even though you can't see it, you can feel its presence sitting in the back seat right behind you. Sometimes you can actually make out the phantom. It's the ghost of a little girl. But as you drive away from the cemetery, the spectral presence disappears. Perhaps the strangest legend claims that you should never carry pork in your car if you're driving on Highway 61. This was true as well for the original Pali Road when it was just a main passageway over the mountains. If you do have any of the taboo pork with you, your car will stall or break down somewhere along the road, usually stranding you in a dark, deserted area, until the meat is removed from your car. In one retelling of the story, a taxi driver crossing the Nuanapali was grabbed from behind by an invisible force as she passed through one of the tunnels. The unseen specter pushed her body and head into the steering wheel, almost causing her to crash, but it let go as soon as the driver exited the tunnel. When she later cleaned out her car, she found a half-eaten pork sandwich left in the car by a passenger. In Kami's favorite version of the ghost story, if the spirits stop your car on the highway because you're carrying pork, a phantom white dog will appear next to your car. All you have to do to get your car running again is crack your window and drop out the meat. As soon as the dog has eaten it, the canine will vanish, and at the same moment, your car engine will start up. Kami loved to strike out on his own to investigate all these spooky stories. According to Hawaiian tradition, his name meant seeker, and he knew that people who have that name are said to be able to uncover secrets and hidden truths. Indeed, Kami never took what people said at face value. He had to examine what he was told to make sure for himself before he was able to believe. Yes, Kami fit him like a glove. How could his parents have known when he was only a few days old that it would be the perfect name for him? Had Grandfather Maleko, who understood such things, told them to name him that? Who knows? The sun had set, and Kami realized that he had to be careful. There were no houses in sight, and as he left the old Pali Highway far behind, there was little light, and it was hard to make out the trail. At first he thought he was imagining it, but rising over the whisper of the grass, he could make out the faint sounds of men's voices, singing, steady, soft, but intense. They were accompanied by the rhythm of drums and an ohe hano ihu, the bamboo nose flute. The voices seemed to be coming from up ahead, just over the next ridge. They got stronger. The men must be getting closer. As Kami reached the top of the hill, he saw the flickering, not from flashlights or distant traffic, but from fire. He could make out dozens of separate flames coming from the ends of handheld torches. The shadowy figures carrying them were walking, four or six across, drawing towards him on the earthen path. Kami stopped abruptly, puzzled. Who would be out here in the desolate fields in the dark carrying torches and chanting? And then it struck him. They were the Night Marchers. The Night Marchers, or the Hoaki o Kapo, as they were known in Hawaiian, were ghosts of venerated warriors, chiefs, or even deities that roamed the earth. Although they could materialize any time, they often appeared between dusk and dawn on one of the special nights at the end of the month on the Hawaiian calendar that was dedicated to the native gods. As they traveled from ancient battlefields, the marchers collected the souls of dead chieftains and warriors, as well as their descendants, both male and female. As they passed, spirits of the dead, who were worthy, would join their ranks. Then the entire parade would move on, heading either towards the nearest Hiawaha, or a temple in normal speak, one of the outcroppings or beach promontories that acted as a jumping-off point to the next world, or to some other sacred spot unknown to mortals. Kami had thought the night marchers were only a myth, like all the other ghost stories. But now, here, one of those myths had come to life and was about to meet him face to face. He tried desperately to remember everything his grandfather had told him about the night marchers. He knew an encounter with them could be deadly. In fact, they usually were. Over the years, police had found the bodies of people lying on the ground, face up, their eyes and mouth wide open, their arms frozen in place in front of them as they had died trying to fight off assailants. But there were never any marks on the corpses, and there were no signs of assault. Medical examiners decided that the victims had died of heart attacks, but native Hawaiians raised on tales of the fearsome night marchers knew what had really happened. Kami's mind raced. What was he supposed to do to survive? That's right. First of all, don't look any of them in the eye. Don't try to run. You don't want to catch their attention if they haven't seen you yet. Quickly judge which way they're heading and get out of the way. Then stop and drop to the ground. The warrior seemed to be following the old dirt footpath that had been worn into the hillside long before the old Pele Highway was made. Kami got off the trail and moved swiftly about 20 feet to one side. If the men didn't spread out too wide and he was lucky, they might miss him. Kami got down. He lay there, panting and terrified as the phantoms grew closer and closer. He knew that even lying on the ground, he wasn't safe. He was supposed to do something else. What was it? He let his mind drift back. "Tell me, Grandfather," he whispered to himself. "Tell me, what do I do?" Then, as if in a dream, he could see himself as a young boy. There he was, 6 years old, sitting by his grandfather, and the old man was talking about the dreaded night marchers. Some of the elders say that when you see them, you are to lie on the ground with your eyes closed, say nothing and breathe, as little as possible, until long after the spirits have passed. Some say that it helps if you take off all your clothing and lay face upwards. But why would I do that? They would see everything. Yes, that's the point, grandson, but that is what may save you. As the warriors and the chief's guards pass you by, they will see you there, undressed, and cry, "Shame on you for being uncovered." They will feel you have dishonored yourself and your ancestors, so they will leave you behind without stopping. There is no guarantee that it will work, but it could possibly save your life. Without a second thought, Kami ripped off his shirt. Soon he was down to his underwear. Even in legends, you only had to strip down to your loincloth. When he realized that it was too late, they were upon him. He kept his head down, but he didn't dare look directly at them. It would mean instant death. But Kami couldn't resist taking a peek. He lifted his eyes just as two warriors raised their spears. "Strike him." "No, stop. He's mine." From behind the guards, a third warrior stepped forward. "The boy is my flesh and blood, of my family. You will not harm him." He pushed past the specters that were just about to kill Kami, turned towards them, and planted his feet in front of the boy, shielding him. The two guards hesitated for only a moment, then they moved back to join the procession. Kami sat there for how long? 5 minutes? A half hour? He didn't know. The glimmer of torchlight disappeared as the ranks of the night marchers moved over the next ridge. The sounds of their chanting, the drums, the flutes faded in the wind. Still, the lone guardian stood over him, and Kami didn't move. Then he remembered. Only an Amakua, the spirit of some ancestor that marched with the Phantom Warriors, could protect you once they had turned against you. So who was his savior? The warrior looked down at the boy, who was now shivering nearly naked under the moonlit sky. "You may open your eyes, my grandson. You learned well, and you are safe." Kami stared up at the spirit hovering over him. The warrior was young, powerful, and handsome. The passage into the other world had changed his appearance back to the time long before Kami had been born. Yet the man was unmistakable. The protector standing before him was his grandfather, Maleko. Of course, Maleko. His grandfather's name was Hawaiian for warlike. His grandfather, who had chosen to take part in the Native uprising all those years ago, was descended from warriors. No wonder he was now one of the night marchers. Kami was going to live. He had never felt such love for his grandfather until that moment. "Yes, you are safe now, my foolish, brave grandson. I could not let them hurt you. One day, if you wish, you may join us. For you come from a long line of warriors. But for now, my little Kami, aloha." And with that, the apparition dissolved. He had gone to join his fellow night marchers. "Mahalo, grandfather," thought Kami. "Thank you." That was a good one. I mean, aside from me being completely unable to pronounce all the Hawaiian names, fun story nonetheless. This next one is about the funeral cortege of Baynard Plantation. While there are stories of phantom stagecoaches and wagons galore, the sightings of a spectral horse-drawn funeral carriage is a rare sight indeed. For more than 100 years, that's what some local residents of one South Carolina seaside resort claim to have seen. And it turns out the cortege is more than just a trip to the graveyard. It's also searching for a missing cadaver. Today, Hilton Head Island is a dream vacation getaway located in South Carolina along the Georgia border. The Atlantic Ocean Retreat is just 20 miles outside of Savannah. With all the multi-million dollar resorts, 12 miles of snow-white sand, and more than 24 premier golf courses, Hilton Head is a stop on the PGA Tour. And it's hard to believe, the first bridge onto the island, opening it to automobile traffic, wasn't constructed until 1956. But the story of Baynard Plantation ghosts date back much further to when cotton was king and the island found itself trapped in the struggle between the Union and the Confederate forces during the Civil War. Spanish explorers led by Francisco Gordillo were the first Europeans to make contact with the natives living on the island in 1521. By the 1600s, the land had become English territory. And in 1663, Charles II granted a wide swath of land in the Americas to 8 men known as the Lord Proprietors. That same year, Captain William Hilton sailed from Barbados on the Adventure and visited the region on their behalf. Off the coast of the Carolinas, he gave his name to a particularly attractive small islet island located at the head of Port Royal Sound, dubbing it Hilton Head. So I was really excited to make a night vision and Hilton Head joke, but unfortunately I couldn't find any relation between Paris Hilton and Captain Hilton. But just know, it didn't go over my head. I was desperate to make that joke, and I wish I could. Anyway, in 1776, a sea captain named John Stoney bought 1,000 acres known as Braddock's Point, named for Captain David Cutler Braddock of the half-galley ship Buford, located at the southern end of the island. About 17 years later, he began to build a house on the site, and by 1820 it was completed. Today, most of the existing ruins of the Baynard Plantation are from that very mansion. The Stony Plantation passed by inheritance to a number of heirs until, in 1840, Saucy Jack Stony lost the property to William Eddings Baynard in an all-night poker game. Old Saucy Jack. Don't ever trust him with a deed to a house. Baynard was already a successful planter on Edisto Island, about 30 miles up the coast from Hilton Head Island. And he owned two other island plantations as well. He introduced Sea Island cotton, which he brought from Barbados, onto the Braddock Point property, and it soon flourished. Baynard and his wife Catherine raised four children in the Great House in 1849. At the age of 49, Baynard died of yellow fever. He was buried in an antebellum above-ground mausoleum in the cemetery of Zion Chapel of S., a tiny wooden Episcopal church that had been built on the plantation for the owners in 1788. In December of 1860, South Carolina was the first state to secede from the United States, and by the time the war broke out, more than 20 working plantations were on Hilton Head Island, and the Baynard Plantation was one of the finest. Fortifications were built on the island in July of 1861 to protect the area from Union forces. But that November, Northern troops gained control over the region after winning the Battle of Port Royal. More than 10,000 Yankee troops poured onto the island, but by then the Baynard family had fled. Union troops moved into their plantation house without a struggle, and they remained there, using the property as a headquarters until the end of the war. Thinking that the Baynards may have hidden some of their treasures in the family mausoleum to recover later, looters broke into their tomb at Zion and no valuables were discovered, that is, unless you count the corpse of William Baynard. They emptied the sepulchre, even removing Baynard's body, and his remains have never been recovered. Sometime between August and December of 1867, the manor went up in flames. Some think it was torched by a band of ex-Confederate raiders. Regardless, by the time Hilton Head Island was resettled after the Civil War, there was nothing left standing on the Baynard property, and there was no reason for the family to return. They did go to court, though, to regain the legal title to the land about 15 years later, but they never moved back onto the island. Today, little more than a few foundations of the mansion remain. There are ruins of a few outbuildings, probably the quarters for the slaves who acted as servants in the main house, part of the chimney from the overseer's lodgings, and a small structure that most likely acted as a reinforcement for Union tents. There's not much more to see, though, but that hasn't stopped the ghost of William Baynard from returning home. In 1956, developer Charles Fraser opened Sea Pines Resort, a master-planned enclave designed as a family holiday destination. Hilton Head Island has grown in leaps and bounds ever since. It has become subdivided into private residential gated communities called plantations, but they're not to be confused with the Civil War-era plantation estates. Each one offers its own blend of spas, golf facilities, beaches, and oceanfront views. More than 2 million tourists now visit Hilton Head annually, and over the past half century, quite a few have been shocked to witness a most unusual sight, and that is the ghostly funeral cortege of William Baynard. A cortege is just a prim and proper white people funeral procession from back in the day. According to the stories, on moonlit nights, his ghost can be seen riding in a black, draped, horse-drawn carriage at the front of a funeral procession. His carriage is followed by the phantoms of his slaves, dressed in plush red velvet, grieving for their master. The sad parade travels the old roads from the plantation ruins to Highway 278, heading towards the family mausoleum, which is near the intersection with Matthews Drive. The Zion Chapel itself is gone, but the small cemetery remains. The Baynard Mausoleum, built in 1846, is still there. In fact, it's the oldest intact building and largest antebellum structure on Hilton Head Island to this very day. The cortege stops at each plantation along the route. Baynard's ghost steps out of his coach, walks slowly to the gate, pauses briefly, and then returns to the carriage. It's said that his spirit is searching for his body so he can return it to the family crypt. So if you see the ethereal parade go by, please give way. The restless specter of William Baynard has been disturbed more than enough for one lifetime and the next.
Thank you.
This next one is called Occurrence at the Creek Road Bridge. If you put five skeptics on a ghost hunt out in the middle of nowhere, you can be sure nothing supernatural is going to show up. Or will it? Imagine the shock when the men in this tale discover that someone may have been trying to deliver a message from the beyond after all, just not in the way they expected it. The other four guys in the van weren't really sure what they were doing there, but Sean had talked them into it. And, well, whenever he cooked up some harebrained scheme, it usually turned out to be worth doing, if only for laughs. But this time they weren't so sure. Standing on the Oak Creek Bridge in the crisp autumn air at 11 p.m. with their teeth chattering and their toes going numb, they wondered whether this might have been an expedition better taken in the middle of summer. The whole area surrounding Camp Comfort County Park, just south of Ojai, California, has a reputation for being a hotbed of haunted activity. More than a dozen ghosts are said to appear on that stretch of Creek Road between Oak View and Ojai. First of all, there are three ghost riders. One is a woman on horseback who appears each year on the anniversary of the day her horse got spooked by a snake on the trail and threw her to her death. The next phantom rider is a black-clothed headless horseman. The third is a motorcycle rider also missing his head, who chases unlucky drivers down the lonely road. The most famous Creek Road boogeyman, the Char Man, might not be a ghost at all. At least he wasn't at first. According to legend, a farmer and his son were trapped in their burning house in the hills just south of town during a massive brush fire that swept through the Ojai Valley in 1948. The father was killed, but the boy managed to survive. Horribly burned by the flames, he was driven mad from the pain of his injuries. For some reason, perhaps an insane attempt to try to save his dad's life, he literally peeled the skin off his father's cadaver and hung him from a tree by the heels. The boy, hideously charred, escaped into the forest. Before long, he began to rush out of the woods and jump into the road, scaring or even attacking motorists. And woe to anybody who was stupid enough to call out his name. Some believe the Charman, deformed, repulsive, and deranged, is still alive. Others say, after so many years, that the young man has certainly died and that it's his ghost haunting the passerbys on Creek Road. There are also specters that haunt the concrete bridge spanning San Antonio Creek, just about 50 yards north of the park's campground. One, the spirit of a murdered bride still in her wedding dress, appears by the side of the road. The specters of two young children dressed in 1800s-era clothing walked the bridge balancing on the rail before falling to their deaths in the stream. There's a disembodied ghostly hand of a child that scampers along the very same railing. And on a rainy night, you can hear the screams from a school bus full of children that skidded off the bridge in the 1930s and plunged into the creek below. Yes, you can truly hear every single one of the road legends at this one spot. But it wasn't one of those phantoms the five young men sought that unnaturally chilly fall night. They were hoping to meet, or at least contact, the ghost of an unhappy woman who, deciding she had no way to escape her abusive husband, tied one end of a rope around her neck, the other around the bridge railing, and then jumped off. Ever since, her melancholy ghost has been spotted walking the bridge or dangling by a rope over its side. Sean, a professional magician and author, had first heard the tragic story at a well-known Ventura-based paranormal investigator's lecture, Richard Sennett. In fact, as part of the session, the participants had visited the very bridge on which the five guys were now standing. After that first ghost hunt, Sean wanted to learn more. To help him on his nocturnal pursuit, he wanted people who had some knowledge or at least an interest in the supernatural. So he enlisted the help of some semi-reluctant friends who were fellow magicians. One of them, Scott, whom he had convinced to drive, was an innovative tinkerer and could find a novel way to solve just about any magical problem posed to him. David was the intellectual, as well as the youngest of the bunch. Bill was generally acknowledged by his peers to have the best control of any of them over a deck of playing cards. And the last of the fearless foursome was Bill's friend Richard. Out of the entire group, Richard was the only one who wasn't a magician. He was more of what you might call a party dude, and was along primarily to have a good time. Hey, being out with buds beats sitting at home watching late night TV any day of the week. And what if they actually found a ghost? Wouldn't that be cool? So there they all were, holding flashlights, a Ouija board, and a tape recorder. Well, actually it was a boombox because it was 1985, and they were about to stand on a haunted bridge. Getting there had been no easy task. The 6 miles of Creek Road in question runs through one of the most out-of-the-way stretches of the Ojai Valley. The path's two lanes, often overhung with low-hanging branches of ancient oaks, cut through the rural landscape of broad fields and pasture land that's crisscrossed by small streams gurgling their ways along the side of the road. A few solitary ranches and homes dot the low hills as well. When it's dark, a drive along Creek Road can be especially unnerving. The lack of street lights makes the environs jet black, pierced only by the beams of car headlights, which cast deep, creepy shadows along both sides of the highway. Above your head, the stars and moon are so intense that they seem close enough to touch. Scott had pulled his van to the side of the road, just a few feet from the bridge near an empty campground that was closed for the season. The five men got out and were immediately immersed in an inky darkness and a surreal stillness. Rather than provide comfort, the calm added a feeling of apprehension to the adventure. They turned on their flashlights and made a quick sweep of the surroundings, switched on the boombox's recorder, and stepped onto the bridge. And of course, there was nothing. No sudden apparition, no banshee wailing in the darkness, nothing at all. There was a collective sigh of relief. As much as the guys didn't want to admit it, they were just as happy to have not run into some crazy entity. Ghost hunting is all well and good in theory, but who knows how you'll react if you're actually confronted by something from the, quote, other side. Now confident that they weren't going to be attacked without warning, they moved farther out onto the bridge. There was nothing special about it. It was a typical back road, two-lane country bridge, just wide enough for traffic to safely pass. But then Sean felt it. The temperature around him suddenly dropped by at least 10 degrees. It was as if he'd stepped into a small circular shaft of icy air, but there was no draft, no wind. It was just a column of cold air over a precise spot about halfway across the bridge. One by one, each member of the crew felt the ice-cold air for himself. It was there, all right. Sean had not imagined it. After a bit of investigation, they discovered that the cold spot didn't start on the pavement above the bridge. It was actually a vertical shaft of frigid air that extended all the way from the brook far below, up, and through the bridge. A common paranormal phenomenon, cold spots are thought to be either evidence of ghostly presence or perhaps a portal through which spirits pass from one plane of existence to another. But if that is the case, thought Sean, and that was where the suicidal wife had hanged herself, why was the cold spot located 8 feet away from the railing? Then it struck him. The bridge had been widened. The woman had lived in the area when the most common transportation was on horseback. To accommodate cars and the ever-increasing truck traffic from the valley, several feet had been added to each side of the one-time narrow road when it was paved. The cold spot where the side of the bridge and railing would have been when the woman was alive. It still marked the precise location where she had hanged herself. So it was time to go to work. They put down the heavy tape recorder and set up the Ouija board on the pavement inside the cold circle. Two of them rested their fingertips lightly on the planchette, which had been carefully placed in the center of the board, and they waited. Is anyone here? No reply. Complete silence and no movement on the board. Is there anyone here that can hear my voice? We would like to talk to you. Slowly at first, then with increasing speed, the planchette began to move. As the pointer shifted from one letter to the next, the men jotted them down onto a piece of paper. The disappointment was obvious on the faces of the group. However, even dimly lit as they were beneath the overhead glow of the flashlight's beams, the letters the planchette were pointing at didn't spell anything. Even a true believer in the occult would have to admit that the sequence was pure gibberish. Time and time again they tried with different questions and different people manning the planchette. But it was always with the same result. A short, excited burst of incomprehensible bullshit and then nothing. For more than an hour and a half they tried, and then, frustrated, weary, and chilled to the bone, they reluctantly decided to call it a night. Their mood was downcast as they walked back to the van. For all the hope with which they had started the evening, their quest had been a complete failure. True, they had encountered a cold spot, which may or may not have had a natural explanation, but otherwise, they had made absolutely no contact with the spirit world. There were no voices, no messages, and certainly no fucking ghosts. Scott started up the van, turned off Creek Road, back onto the main highway out of Ojai, and before long, the bridge was far behind him. The next day, Sean started thinking about their nocturnal exploits. He had worked with Ouija boards before, and this was the first time that virtually nothing had been spelled out by the planchette moving from letter to letter. True, in other sessions that they had done, the, quote, answers he received often had no correlation to the questions that he had asked the spirits, but this time all they'd gotten was a jumbled mess. He checked and rechecked the letters they had marked down, but no matter how he split the letters into groups, he couldn't form a single recognizable word. There were no hidden messages. Perhaps the problem was with the questions, he thought. Maybe if he checked the audio tape, he'd find something he'd missed. He rewound the tape, donned a set of headphones, and hunkered down to listen to 2 hours of nothing. As he'd expected, there were no surprises. At least, there were none at first. There was the small talk and banter, the guy's glee at finding the cold spot, the busy sounds of setting up the Ouija board, the unanswered questions. But then Sean realized that for whatever reason, he hadn't turned off the boombox's recorder when they were finished with the session with the Ouija board. He had kept it running the whole time that they were packing up and setting off for the van. He could hear the gravel crunching under their feet, and they left the bridge and headed down to the foot of the hill where Scott had parked. He heard them joking about why the spirits hadn't shown up. Maybe they were too busy tearing the van apart to talk to us. Yeah, maybe when we get there, the tires will be gone, and there'll be a big red letter sprayed on the windshield saying you're not leaving. What? Stunned, Sean stopped the tape. What was that? He quickly rewound the tape and listened again. A hoarse voice, definitely not one of the five men's, whispered, "What?" Not a question exactly, just a simple, strong declaration. What? Sean's mind started to race. The voice on the recording was unquestionably female, but there had been no woman with them the night before. In fact, they hadn't run into anyone the entire time that they were at the bridge. The place had been deserted. He replayed the tape again and again. The voice was definitely there. Had there already been something on the tape that the recorder failed to record over? Maybe. Or had noise bled through from the other side of the tape? No. He distinctly remembered that halfway through the night he had opened a brand new tape on the bridge and put it into the recorder, and the boombox had never left his sight. Had he carried it in some way that accidentally brushed the microphone and created what sounded like a person talking? Could someone have coughed or sneezed in such a way that it could be mistaken for a voice? Popping in a new tape, Sean tried to recreate the sound, but to no avail. He was startled by a hard, loud rap on the door and looked up. It was Scott. "What's up, Sean? You look like you've seen a ghost." "Not funny, Scott. Listen to this." Sean told his friend about the unusual voice, placed the old tape back into the recorder, handed Scott the headset, and hit play. Though Scott was the hardcore cynic of the bunch, he dutifully put on the headphones. After just a few moments, a shocked expression appeared on his face. Scott pulled off the earphones and threw them across the room. "Man, what was that? Don't ever play that tape for me again." "You mean you heard the voice?" "Yeah, sure I heard the voice, and the breathing too." "Huh." Sean had realized he'd never listened to the tape all the way through. He'd always shut it off as soon as he heard the voice. He plugged the headset in, rewound the tape, and listened, and sure enough, there it was. "What?" Followed by a few moments later by the low but distinct sound of a person exhaling three times. One exhale right after the other. And the most frightening part of all of it was that the three breaths sounded much closer to the microphone than the voice had been. Whatever had made that sound had been standing in the middle of the five guys, right next to Sean. With an almost fanatic fervor, Sean began to rethink the exact conditions of the night before. Richard had a slight cold. Could the breath have been his? No. The boombox had two sensitive mics that recorded in stereo. By listening carefully, Sean could position each of the five men, identifying their voices as well as the breathing, and tell how far they had been from the tape recorder. The exhaling that had followed the mysterious what had definitely not come from any of them. Over the next few days, Sean visited the other three friends who had accompanied him on the haunted bridge. All of them heard the voice on the tape. All of them heard the deep breaths. All of them were dumbfounded. None of them had heard anything out of the ordinary that night, but they had to admit they had captured something extraordinary on tape. As we pull over and park at the end of today's eerie exploration of haunted roads, I find myself already looking forward to our next ghostly journey down America's shadowy highways. I truly enjoyed delving into today's subject matter, and I'm thrilled to share that we'll be cruising these spectral streets again in an upcoming episode. But for now, I must shift gears and get ready for work. Before I go, make sure to explore the other chilling tales our network offers. Check out Scary Jerry's gripping podcast, Demented Darkness and Dark Side of the Nerd, as well as Foxhound 43 on Rumble for more thrilling content. Please don't forget our eerie array of merchandise is waiting for you at aohpmerch.com. Whether you're looking to sport a spooky tee or grab a ghastly mug, your support keeps our stories alive and haunting. However, I understand that times are tough and not everybody can financially contribute to the show. But if you want to support us without spending a dime, consider rating, reviewing, and sharing the show with your friends. These simple acts help us immensely by improving our visibility through algorithms and bringing new listeners into our creepy fold. And it will also fill me with a huge, huge sense of pleasure if we stay on the top 200 charts, the Webby people nominate us for a Webby, and I can tell them to go fuck themselves, because fuck them. Anyway, thank you for joining me on today's haunted road trip. The road is always waiting to tell its tales. And until the next one, stay spooky and good night, everybody. Thank you for listening.
I was a highwayman along the coach roads I did ride, with a sword and pistol by my side. Many a young maid lost her baubles to my trade. Many a soldier shed his lifeblood on my blade. The bastards hung me in the spring of 25, but I'm still alive. I was a sailor, and I was born upon the tide. With the sea I did abide, and I sailed a schooner around the Horn of Mexico. And I went aloft to furl the mainsail and blow. When the odds broke off, they said that I got killed, but I'm living still. And I was a dam builder, across this river deep and wide, where steel and water did collide. In a place called Boulder on the wild Colorado,
Well, I slipped and fell into the wet concrete below. They buried me in that gray tomb that knows no sound. But I'm still around, and I'll always be around and around. I flew a starship across the universe divide. When I reached the other side, I'll find a place to rest my spirit if I can. Perhaps I may become a highwayman again. Or I may simply be a single drop of rain, and I will remain, and I'll come back again.